with a little bit of sadness that this is Dan Spencer's last presentation. And he's made it through with hardly any voice at the end. So thank you for being persistent.
Too much good conversation.
Yeah, I know. You've just been talking too much with all these good people, right? Friendly reminder, I put teaching session evaluations on the fire pit. These are for any teaching faculty other than Living Word this week, so we greatly appreciate you writing comments and filling those out, so I encourage you to do that. So it is with my pleasure I introduce one last time Dan Spencer, Professor of Environmental Studies at the University of Montana in Missoula, for this last topic today. Thank you very much, Dan.
Thank you so much, Sharon. It's been such a pleasure working with you, and thank you all for being here for one more session on this series of things on Earth Ethics, which are a series of case studies from a book that I was able to write with a couple friends of mine, Jim Martin Schramm and Laura Stivers, both of whom also have, all of us have strong holding connections here. Let me just ask you again the question in the beginning. For how many of you is this the first time you've been in class for this session, this series here? Just a couple, just a handful here. What I'd like to do, I want to spend a lot of time on it, but we've been talking about three kind of main questions that help us frame how we think about environmental ethics, and they can help us in orienting here. But rather than me repeating myself, I'm going to just see if there are people here in the room who would be able to tell us what's involved in each of these three here. And maybe I'll pick on Barbara Lundland, my friend here, to just talk about what's the question we're trying to think about in this first spectrum between anthropocentric approaches or biocentric approaches to ethics?
Well, anthropocentric is very hard to say, but it is mainly that human beings are the center of everything,
yep.
And more important than anything. And biocentrism takes a much wider view that all of life forms. I'm not sure if it includes things like water. We haven't talked much about that.
That's a really good point. Biocentricity means life-centered, and it's most of our Western tradition has been human-centered. We've used the human community, human well-being, as a way to think about ethical issues. People are asking now if that's too narrow. We need to think about all of life and the implications of all of life on that. When we actually start asking about things beyond life, like water, rivers, oceans, ecosystems, we move into this second one here, which is reflects kind of a long-standing tension between should we focus primarily on the well-being of individuals. Historically, that's been individual human beings, so we have a Bill of Rights in our Constitution that does that. Now, if we expand it to a biocentric approach, this would include all of the animals. So yesterday, when we looked at the issue of moral eating, we looked about whether animals have rights. But others have said the primary focus should be on the whole well-being of our ecological communities, our ecosystems. So thinking about our rivers, our waters, our prairies, our ecosystem we live in on there. And then I'll pick on my former student, Rebecca. What's at stake in this third one here? What are we talking about with this between status quo reform and radical ecology?
Well, I think a lot of this might speak for itself in a lot of movements. We see arguments when we're talking about some of our major disagreements or our major crises, in this case, the environmental crisis, some might say that we can do things, you know, within our current, whatever it is, economic system, our current anthropocentric viewpoint. That would be more of a status quo argument. People who say that we can manipulate the market, that's a status quo argument. Reform still kind of takes into account whatever is the status quo, and keeps a lot of its ideas, but just talks about making it a little bit more equitable or maybe more humane or just ethical. And then there are others, a lot of biocentric viewpoints might take this view, or even a lot of animal rights activists. So they're more reform, but radical ecology would call for a complete overturn of the system. Whatever the system is.
Yeah, really helpful. Let me give you one example. For example, this final spectrum for people within Christianity. Take the biblical teaching of dominion. Historically, dominion has oftentimes been interpreted as an anthropocentric thing where we have the right to use nature however we want because God gave us dominion over that. Some people have said, no, that's not a helpful interpretation. A better biblical interpretation, you need to rethink that. Perhaps dominion means actually refraining from harming nature. We exercise God's dominion by refraining from it and allowing nature to flourish. So we still retain the notion of dominion, but we're rethinking it in light of our ecological crisis. And then there are others who simply say, no, we need to get rid of the notion of dominion altogether. Dominion perpetuates a separation of humans from the rest of the planet. It's not a helpful concept. The same way that some of the Bible justified slavery, we no longer see that as authoritative. We should simply not see dominion as something that's helpful. We need a new take on that. So all three of them would be Christian responses, but they would take different approaches to one, maintaining a traditional approach, a second one, rethinking and reforming it, and a third one saying that approach is simply no longer appropriate today. And that comes up in a lot of our traditions. Part of it has to do with the vision we have for where we're headed here. And so in a radical ecology perspective, which we'll see in this case as well, we'll argue we need a really an ecological perspective of everything we do. An anthropocentric perspective would say, no, we need to keep human beings as the sole center frame of reference. We can treat our resources wisely, but we should use them for how they help the human community. And then there are many people in between who say, no, there are legitimate claims for other forms of life and ecosystems, but human beings will probably still be centered, but we need to think about them as well. So that whole range will come up in things here. I'm going to actually, Mom, would you flip up the lights behind you there? I just want to make sure I have enough vision on this here. So the first two cases we looked at on Wednesday, we looked at the issue, it was a case called Maybe One, and it was looking at the intersection of very personal decisions about maybe starting a family with the broader implications of human population, consumption, and climate change. So it was really kind of a universal question that almost all of us will consider at some point or another as we think about how we live, either with our own children, grandchildren, godchildren, nieces, nephews, whatever, on that. Yesterday, we looked at something that's also very intimate to all of us. That's the question of eating. All of us eat. We all make decisions about that. So we have to think about that. And we looked at the variety of issues around the question about whether or not we should eat animals and how we should be structuring our agriculture systems. Today is a little bit different one because this is a very context-specific issue. But for the how many folks here live in the West? Quite a few. How many folks here come to the West and care about it deeply? All right, most of us do. The issue of water in the West and the issue of the wildlife that inhabits the West is an issue that's really important to many of us here. This is an issue, my sister Martha's here in the room, and she actually was a consultant with me on this particular case because we grew up and spending our summers at a family cabin not far from Mount Shasta, which is one of the Cascade volcanoes pictured here. And this is a wonderful starting picture here because Mount Shasta is at the edge of a very arid part of California called the Klamath Basin. Historically, it had a lot of wetlands, a lot of very shallow lakes and wetlands. It was home to millions of birds every year in the flyway there. Also very rich fishery in that area there. This area began to be settled about 150 years ago by white settlers who saw the potential for draining the wetlands to produce really rich agriculture. And that's what proceeded to happen in the early 1900s. Bureau of Reclamation began a very extensive project to drain the wetlands and convert it to farmland, and it's some of the richest farmland in the world. But because it's such an arid area, it requires irrigation. The average rainfall in this area is maybe 10 to 12 inches a year, which puts it as close to desert or semi-desert, which you see in the surrounding area. A lot of sagebrush, juniper, pine, pinyon pine, kind of stuff like that there. And so this was the dominant pattern in the 20th century of converting this whole area, attracting settlers to settle this farm economy, developed a very strong farm economy. There was also other forms of natural resource extraction. There was a lot of timber logging going on in the area when I was growing up, not so much now, still ranching and still fishing. So what I'd like to do by the case today, we'll do it a little bit differently than the two we've done before. I'm still going to get you to discussing some things in small groups, but I want to start by actually giving you a lot of background on this case because it's so case-specific. And then you're going to see one of the things that comes up in the case, how many folks here had a chance to read through it? You get a sense, quite a few of you did, so which is great because it'll help me divide that up. I also have some cases here. So one of the things that's happened after the last 17, 18 years have been particularly contentious, but one of the things that's come out of it is some proposed legislation to try to resolve some of these issues here. So what I'd like to do is to conduct our class today as a hearing on that legislation. Yes. I'm going to represent Dan Snyder, who works for the office of Senator Dianne Feinstein, and has come to have a hearing in the Tule Lake area about whether or not we should pass this legislation. And I'm going to ask you all to represent the constituents of that area, the variety of the constituents. But to do that, I want to give you some background to help you understand the issues in it. So this is the Klamath River watershed. My sister Martha lives right in this area here near Eureka. Our family cabin is right just south of Tule Lake. This is the Medicine Lake volcano. We live right in that area there. The area we're going to be talking about is the upper Klamath Basin. One of the things that's very distinctive about this watershed is it's reversed from the way most watersheds are. Most watersheds start, like if you look, for example, the Missouri River. Montana is a headwater state of the Missouri River. Most watersheds start in a mountainous area where you have high, steep mountains, snowfall, lakes, and so forth. The rivers come out of that flowing in a very rapid creek, like Railroad Creek does here. And then they eventually meet a much flatter area, like the Midwest, and eventually go into a delta, like in New Orleans, that area there. The Klamath River is the opposite. The mountains are in the lower part of it. The upper part is very, very broad, arid, and kind of shallow. But historically, it was filled with lots and lots of shallow lakes. These are the remnants of them here. You can see it over here in this area here, the coastal mountains here. So the Klamath watershed starts in this broad upper basin here and then plunges through this area here. This was tremendous salmon habitat historically. Historically, the Klamath River was the third most productive watershed for salmon production on the entire West Coast. So it teemed with salmon. Now it's somewhere about 5 to 6% of the salmon that historically were there are remaining in the water. And part of the real challenge of that is because when water has been diverted to irrigate the upper basin, which takes it out of the watershed here, which has really harmed the salmon downstream. Also, the diversion of water in the upstream here has harmed several native fish that required these watersheds, these lakes and wetlands for survival in that year. So that's kind of a historical background. We're going to be talking primarily about this area here, but it all has ramifications for this area here. And as we'll see, the salmon fishermen who are downstream and several tribes who historically live in this area also making claims on this water here. Historically, this was the area of the Klamath and Modoc tribes. They lived in Northern California, Southern Oregon. They were part of a larger group called the Snake River Paiute. You can see the division of several of the different historical homelands of the tribal groups in this area here. One of the ironies, of course, is the Klamaths and the Modocs were historical rivals. Then when we'll talk about their history a little bit, eventually when they were put on a reservation together, this was a pattern we see throughout the West, that tribes that historically were enemies were actually clustered together to share reservations when they lost their homelands. But they were, the Klamath and the Modocs in particular, were kind of a typical hunter-gatherer society, but a lot of emphasis on fishing. They had such abundant fisheries in this area here that they could live very well and live locally from the fishing on that here. The history of the tribes is that as the white settlers moved into this area here and began to do ranching and agriculture, there was a lot of conflict with the tribes over land use here. And so the Klamath Reservation was created in 1864, and the Modocs and the Klamaths and a couple other tribes were all put together in, this was the original boundary of the Klamath Basin there. So Klamath Falls was just outside it to the south here, and most of the Klamath Basin, which was their historical area, was excluded from the reservation. The reservation was much more actually timber country on this area here, but still they had a pretty large reservation with a lot of their historic timberlands and watershed in there. There continued to be a lot of conflicts between folks in there, and so a little less than 100 years after the Klamath Reservation was formed, the Klamath Termination Act was passed in 1953, and it revoked federal recognition of the Klamath tribes as a federally recognized tribe. This was part, some of you may know this history in the West. There was a whole period post-World War II which was called termination. And there was a federal policy, and the thinking was that tribe and Native Americans would be better if they were assimilated into white society, and they would have better access to education, economics, so forth and that. And so mostly against the tribes' wills, they lost their federal status and were forcibly assimilated into white society. In many places, their children were taken from the families and put in Christian or white boarding schools, were not allowed to speak their native language, and the whole effort was to try to destroy the tribal identity to get people to assimilate into white society. That happened to the Klamath tribe. When they lost their federal status in 1953, they also lost their reservation. So all of their lands were taken and either turned over to private logging interests or incorporated into the national forest system there. The Klamath tribes protested this from the beginning. Finally, a little over 30 years later, in 1986, the Klamaths regained their tribal recognition, but they didn't regain their lands. The reservation was not given them. So they now have a very, very small reservation near the area of Chiloquin there. Like many tribes here who have been denied a lot of their traditional access, they make their living partly from having a casino, and part of their is there. That's the one thing they've been able to do. But they still try to conduct a lot of their traditional life, which revolves particularly around their sacred fish in this area there. So that's kind of a tribal background on the area there. The conflicts between white settlers and the tribal groups culminated in the Modoc War, 1872 to 1873, which was conducted just south of the Oregon-California border here in an area known as Tule Lake. There's a national monument today called Lava Beds National Monument, which has the historical site. It was a fairly amazing thing. About 148 Modocs held off 3,000 U.S. federal troops for a year and a half because they knew the terrain so well, and it's a very rugged volcanic lava terrain there. But eventually they were starved out there. It's the only Indian wars in which a U.S. general was killed. General William P. Canby was killed in this war here. But that set up a pattern then, and the Modocs then in turn were sent to Oklahoma. They were taken out of this area, sent to Oklahoma as part of the Indian territories there. It was only much later that they were able to return to their ancestral lands and join the Klamaths in the tribal area there. The other thing that this map shows, however, is the very, very extensive lakes. Tule Lake, Lower Klamath Lake, part of Clear Lake, and then outside of here, Upper Klamath Lake. These were all very shallow but very, very rich, fertile wetlands in the area there. And they had a really, I would say, I don't use the word unique too much because it gets overused, but this is really a unique combination of things here. The volcanic material in the area makes a very, very fertile soil, volcanic acid material. But the other thing is, for millions of years, this is a flyway, the Pacific Flyway, and so birds would land in these areas, and the bird excrement mixed with the volcanic ash to make this incredibly rich soil. So that became the basis for the agriculture in the area there. And it was keyed around, they recognized from the very beginning, the only way they could make agriculture work was to have it be irrigated, because it's so arid there. And so what they did, the Bird Reclamation, which was formed in 1903, one of the very first projects was the Klamath Reclamation Project, started 2 years later. The term reclamation means to reclaim land for human use. Through the West, reclamation has usually been involved with water and irrigation systems there. So originally, Clear Lake was a much smaller lake, but what they did was put a dam on it to make this into a reservoir. Clear Lake is a very interesting internal water system. This area historically was part of the Great Basin, which means it doesn't drain to the ocean, it drains internally. So Clear Lake flowed through a river called the Lost River, because for a long time people didn't know where it came from, flowed out of California into the desert area of Oregon, through this area here, and actually flowed into Tule Lake. Whereas Lower Klamath Lake and Upper Klamath Lake flowed into the Klamath River out to the Pacific Ocean. But Clear Lake and Tule Lake were internally draining, and so Tule Lake was dependent on the water that came through this watershed. What the reclamation projects did was they put a reservoir here to raise the level to store the water and supply. They drained almost all of Tule Lake, about 90%, drained all of Lower Klamath Lake, and turned those into agriculture. So as you see this here now, you can see this is the former outline of historical Tule Lake. There's now what they call the Tule Lake Sump, these two little or smaller remaining wetlands areas. but all the rest of this is agriculture. Almost the entire lower Klamath Lake was turned to agriculture. There still is a little bit of wetlands here, but very ephemeral. And then they also were able to irrigate much of the floodplain along the Lost River there. Clear Lake Reservoir has increased in size to do that. The city of Klamath Falls sits right at the edge of this here, and Upper Klamath Lake also has a dam on it now to control the water levels on that. So what that did was to give a dependent water supply for irrigation and very, very rich agriculture. The third then thing, project of the commission, was to attract settlers to come and settle this land and create an agricultural economy. And what they did through there was a very innovative program on that, is they made the land available through a lottery system to veterans of World War I and World War II. So veterans from World War I and later from World War II who wanted to go into agriculture could put their name into a lottery, and then the lottery, the names were drawn out of the hat, and they were awarded homestead land, and they were given a period of time to make it agriculturally productive. So particularly homesteaders in the Tudor Lake Valley, Martha and I have very close friends that we grew up with in the Staunton family. Their father was a World War I veteran from Virginia, and he moved his family out here, got land. They're now very successful farmers there. So people that are very proud of their history, they see their history rooted as patriotism, as having served their country. They see themselves as having created a vibrant agricultural economy out of a desert area in that area there. And this is the town of Tule Lake when they're welcoming the homesteaders. Now, here's a one little ironic footnote as well. Anybody else know the name of how else Tule Lake was connected to World War II?
The Japanese.
Yes, it was one of the sites of the major relocation internment camps of the Japanese Americans, just south of Tule Lake in a little place called Newell. And so for the duration of the war, there were several thousand Japanese Americans who were interned here. And one of the ironies is World War II ended and the Japanese were allowed to leave, they had all these barracks that they lived in. They gave those barracks to the homesteading families. So the barracks of the former Japanese internment camp became the first houses for these settlers who were coming into that area. So very, just the social history of this area is really interesting. But you can see already that what today is primarily a conservation issue in agriculture is on water, is deeply intertwined with the history of U.S. settlement, of our policy towards Native Americans, displacement of Native Americans, our war history, rewarding veterans of the war, our displacement of Japanese Americans, this area there. So it's a very complicated social history that now is brought up into this environmental history. So on top of that, was this coincided with the awareness of dwindling supplies, particularly of birds, but also other wildlife. And so this whole area has become a network of national wildlife refuges. And these national wildlife refuges, beginning in 1908, the Lower Klamath Wildlife Refuge was formed here in the midst of all the agricultural fields. Then you had the Clear Lake National Wildlife Refuge formed over here, which is around an artificial reservoir. And then 1928, the Tule Lake National Wildlife Refuge created refuge lands of all the former lake beds there, right on up until 1978 is the most recent one, the Bear Valley Refuge in this area here. So national wildlife refuges are set aside to preserve the habitat, particularly of particular kinds of fish, birds, and other wildlife in that area here. And so now you have competing land uses. You have federal agencies administering lands that are set aside to protect the wildlife, but it's also in the midst of an agricultural economy there. This gives you a little sense about this here. This is the remaining two pieces of Tudor Lake, but these are all the former lake beds, which are now thriving agriculture. Areas known particularly for its potatoes, some of the best potato growing country, but also Tudor Lake was for a long time the horseradish capital of the world. They grow horseradish there, they grow grains, lots of different things here. But an added twist is, in contrast to almost every other national wildlife refuge, in 1964 the Kuchel Act was passed, and this act mandated that these refuges continue to be open to agriculture. This part of the debate was whether or not it's appropriate to do agriculture inside a national wildlife refuge. Congress determined not only is it appropriate, they mandated it here. So these wildlife refuges have to have a management that mixes protection of habitat for birds and so forth, but also keeping them open to be leased as agricultural lands. So you're getting a little sense about why this whole history, the complexity. And these kind of complexities is not, I mean, this particular arrangement is unique to Tule Lake, but this is common throughout the West, where our social history, our environmental history, our settlement history interact in really challenging ways. Moving forward here, by the 1970s, we have this increased awareness of vanishing species that people think are of value. And so we get the Endangered Species Act passed late 1970s, early 1980s, and fairly quickly, three main fish in these watersheds are put on the Endangered Species Act. In 1988, the Lost River suckerfish and the short-nosed suckerfish, which were two of the sacred fish for the Modocs and the Klamaths, and the main fish in the Klamath Lake ecosystem, became endangered, primarily because of loss of water due to irrigation, simply not enough water in the streams and rivers to maintain them. A decade later, downstream, the coho salmon, which inhabits mostly the lower part of the watershed, was also put on the Endangered Species Act, or listed as an endangered species. Now, historically, the coho salmon would have gone all the way up to Klamath Lake, but in the early 1900s, four hydroelectric dams were built along the Klamath River, which impedes their movement upstream there. So, since your upper Klamath Lake right is the home to two native suckerfish, it flows in the Klamath River left, where coho salmon spawn. Federal regulators must maintain a delicate balance between lake levels, river flows to protect all three endangered fish species. In fact, one of the really interesting challenges here is that folks in the Fish and Wildlife Service who are responsible for the suckerfish, they want to keep water in Upper Klamath Lake there to protect the fish. The folks responsible for maintaining the well-being of the salmon want more water to be released because they need more water in the Klamath River. And so here you have federal agencies with the same responsibility to protect the fish, but there's actually an inbuilt conflict between protecting the habitat of these two species here. Okay, additional problem here. If you didn't think it was complex, it's more complex. Then the early part of the 20th century was actually a fairly wet period in the West. There, it changes by the end of the 1930s, and that's when we get the Dust Bowl there. But the teens and 20s were fairly wet, which is when they allocated all the water allocation. As a result, the basin actually is over-allocated. On most normal years, there's not enough water to meet all the water rights claims made on it there. This got really aggravated towards the end of the 1990s, when this area had several years in a red drought. And so it culminated in April 2001, when the water levels dropped so precipitously that the Bureau of Reclamation was ordered by the Fish and Wildlife Service to turn off water to all irrigation, to keep enough water in Klamath Lake and the Klamath River to support the fish here. What this did is it cut off 240,000 acres of farmland to farmers right as the harvest area, right as planting season came in April 2001. The farmers who were counting on this water had no water, so that enormous protests in that area there. So you see, this was the Klamath Falls paper there, the Klamath Herald, no water for most farmers in that area there. Set up an enormous social protest. The Klamath Bucket Brigade formed. You can see up there on the right there, the thing says, save your home, stop rural cleansing. The farmers began to argue that the true endangered species in the area were the farmers, and that what this really was a conspiracy between the federal government, the tribes, and environmentalists to get rid of farmers. They call it, that's the ethnic cleansing, rural cleansing there. So they formed the Bucket Brigade, let freedom ring, let the water flow, and they went out and physically began to pass water there, and then actually opened up the gates. Other complicating factor. Anybody know what happened in the country in January of 2001? Well, it's a stupid question, many things happened, but we had an inauguration of a new presidential administration. So the previous administration, then the Clinton-Gore administration, had to be strongly environmentally oriented. The new Bush and Cheney administration came and they were much more sympathetic to the farmers. So you had a whole thing intervene. So the federal government intervened and actually overrode the agencies and forced them to open up the water on some of this area again. So it created an enormous conflict there. When they opened up the water, it in turn led to enormous fish kills downstream. So it's between 30,000 and 100,000 salmon died almost overnight because the water was too shallow, it was too warm. the tribes lost a lot of access to fish. So you can see we're heading into a really difficult situation in this area here. Added complication into this, there are these four hydroelectric dams, which are pretty much outdated now. They're not terribly useful. And one of the things they do is they prevent upstream migration of the salmon here and downstream migration of the other areas, as well as the flow. But they've provided pretty cheap hydroelectric power. For many years, they also provide recreation. They have reservoirs by them. People have grown up having access to these reservoirs. So that's an added complication on there. Things begin to come to a head when one of the tribes, the Hoopa Valley tribe, is actually in the lower part of the Klamath Basin there. They sued the federal government under the Endangered Species Act because they were losing access to their salmon, which is both a mainstay for their food and also for their religious, their cultural way of life there. So the lawsuit entered the court system there, which then began to trigger further actions along those lines there. Meanwhile, another group, people who've been largely ignored in this whole thing happening upstream, the salmon fishermen downstream, began to organize, and they pointed out an interesting thing. There had been a lot of attention paid to the loss of farm jobs and the loss of farm income. The salmon fishermen did the numbers and they said, we've actually lost more jobs in salmon fisheries with a higher economic loss. So why does the farmer's loss count and our loss doesn't? So here you've got another added thing. So ironically, the salmon fishermen historically had been a lot of tension with the tribes, now for an alliance with the tribe to try to protect the salmon fisheries and get water to flow again. In 2016, there's been a proposal to have the dams removed. There's been a lot of work done on them. The argument being that we can make water needs in other ways, and this would restore the ecological integrity of the river. As you might imagine, this has been a lot of local observation. If you drive through this area here, you'll see a lot of farms have signs, stop the Klamath Dam scams. One of the things that's been happening is that the farmers have questioned the science behind the Endangered Species Act, stuff like that. And so we think we hear a lot about fake news today. Going back 15 years, they denounced the science as junk science. They denounced the whole approach of what's called the precautionary principle, which you should act before things reach a certain point in order to prevent damage. Farmers said that's just junk science trying to get us out here. So as you can see, in America, we elect our dictators, stop the Klamath Dam scam, really, really high tensions. But on the other hand, you also have the tribes organizing here. Bring the salmon home, remove the Klamath Dams. But even in the tribes, notice this, remember here, my council does not speak for me. The tribes were also divided internally on this issue here. This is a classic picture here, threatened lives, hip high in irrigation boots, potato farmer just crossing from Tule Lake, dips in water from there, and he became part of the Bucker Brigade. So lots and lots of tension, lots of threats of social violence in this area here, a really difficult situation. Now I want to go through one other set of things here, and then I'm going to turn you loose so you can figure out what we should do. I'm going to be conducting a hearing. I want your input as my constituents here. All right? Now, it helps to know a little bit about how water rights law works in the West. And I hope this doesn't make people's eyes shade over here, but it's that anybody who lives in the West or cares about the West, it's worth knowing a little bit about this here. Water rights in the West are different than water rights in the East and the Midwest. Okay? In the Midwest and the East, most water rights go with the land where the water flows. So if you have if you live on a lake, you live in a stream bed, you have access to that water. It doesn't work that way in the West. The West has what's called a split estate. Water rights are separate from land rights. So water you get a right to water if you make what's called beneficial use to it. It's called the doctrine of prior appropriation. Whoever gets to a place and can make beneficial use of water establishes a right to that water, and it operates in first in line, first in time, first in use. So if my family arrives in the 1880s and establishes water for irrigation, and your family arrives in the 1890s and establishes a water right, I have prior rights. So in low flow years, I get water before you do. And if it runs out before it gets to you, you're out of luck. Okay? But the other thing is water rights are established in what's called beneficial use. That is, you have to take the water out of the stream, out of a lake, and put it to things that are defined as beneficial use. These can include things like generating power, for bringing the water out to run a water wheel to power. Most times it's for irrigation. One of the real problems that conservationists encountered was they were trying to buy up these water rights to leave the water in the stream. But the water right by beneficial use, if after a period of time, in many places 5 years, if you haven't taken the water out during those 5 years, you lose the water right. It doesn't allow you to use your water right to leave the water in the stream to benefit the fish. Now, there's the legislations that have been changing that in places there, but this has been one of the real challenges. The presumption 100 years ago was that water, all water in the stream should be put to good use. In fact, the assumption was that the streams should not be flowing by the time they get to the ocean. Because if there's water left in that river, it wasn't put to good use. You should use all the water that's available in the river to put it to beneficial use. We had no concept of ecological dimensions of things here. 100 years later, so people talked about in the 19th century, what you wanted was working rivers. You wanted to use all that water and put it to beneficial use. And we created really thriving economies to do that. 100 years later, people are turning their heads saying, no, we now need rivers that work, that are ecologically sustainable, because we've been against all these other ecological ramifications. When rivers dry up, has all sorts of cascading events. But all these cultures still exist simultaneously. And so, as I mentioned, the basin became over-allocated by water rights there. But a little more complicated. Well, this is just the California Constitution. These are embedded in state constitutions. So it's hereby declared that because of the conditions prevailing in the state, the general welfare requires that the water resources of the state be put to beneficial use to the fullest extent of which they are capable, and that the waste or unreasonable use or unreasonable methods of use of water be prevented. Waste of water is considered leaving it in the stream, it was wasting it. And that the conservation of such waters to be exercised with a view to the reasonable and beneficial use thereof in the interest of the people and for public welfare. This logic made a lot of sense when you had a settlement economy, when you're trying to attract people to settle and develop your state. Now we have more people than the land can sustain, and this part of water use has been really problematic. One other problem here. This is just a really interesting case. It's so complicated here. What the tribes pointed out is that they were given water rights before settlement began. Those rights were ignored the entire 20th century. Now the tribes are coming back and they're using the court system to say, our treaties recognize us as the first water right holders. And the courts are recognizing that. So the tribes have now come in and they actually have the first right to this ocean here. But what the farmers have done, and appropriately so, in our Constitution, we have what's called the Fifth Amendment Taking Clause. And this is an embedded U.S. Constitution, the Fifth Amendment, no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. So we've seen this. If the government wants to build Interstate 90 through Missoula, and its home's there, it can do it, but it has to compensate those homeowners. If you want to build a school or a hospital, you can do it. The government can do it, but it has to compensate them. What emerged in the 1980s, and this is why I say, if you want to go into a fascinating field, go into the field of environmental law. Because what happened in the 1980s was the whole law growing, and people were saying, well, look, you don't have to physically take my land to make it uneconomic. You can put so many regulations on it that I can't use it. And so the takings clause began to be applied to this notion, if the government so regulates your land that you can't use it for beneficial use, the government has to compensate you. And this is what the farmers begin to argue. Farmers argue because of the Endangered Species Act, and things here, they were no longer able to make a living from their land, and they were owed compensation by the government. So the Supreme Court has had to weigh in on this. And they've done three situations when the government must compensate property owners. I realize this is pretty technical. I hope you're finding this interesting.
Yes.
But this is what's so difficult because these issues are so emotional. But there's this very complex histories and then there's a complex law and legislation. So the Supreme Court has said the government must compensate property owners when it permanently physically occupies a project. Okay? That one's been pretty clear. government comes in and says, we need your land for a military base, they can take it. But they have to, if they physically take your land, have to compensate you. If its restrictions or regulations deny all economically viable use of the property, this has been the big hitch. When the farmers took their lawsuit there, the courts ruled they were deprived of some, but not all, economic use of the land. So the courts ruled against the farmers on this here. So the farmers are now trying to get legislation to recognize this one here. Or if some are singled out to bear burdens that should be shared by the whole public. The farmers have also argued this. They're saying we're being forced to bear a disproportionate burden of preserving species there that the whole public should be sharing in compensating us here. And so the whole basis of this is trying to get fairness and equity and reciprocity. And if the public is going to benefit from the environmental protections, how do we share equitably the burdens of those decisions on that? But you could also interestingly look and think about the salmon fishermen. They're also being deprived of their livelihood. Think about the tribes. I mean, part of the interesting thing about this is almost every constituent in this case thinks they are the ones who are being victimized and have had an unjust situation up there. So that's the background. Let me just pause here and just see if there's any questions or things that I can fill in for you before I let you resolve the case. Carmen.
Dan, were the treaties, which have so often been broken, I mean, have they been able legally to go back and say, this treaty still is good and you better honor it?
Yes. So that's the interesting thing. It actually dates back to 1910. In 1910, the tribes already were recognizing this. They went to the Supreme Court, and the courts recognized that their earlier treaty rights predated the Windsor. But it took 80 to 90 years to actually have a legal effect. The tribes are so impoverished, they were being terminated rightly, so they had this legal right throughout the 20th century. But it's only been since basically the 1980s, tribes started sending their own kids to law school. And so when you got tribal lawyers in there who understood the Western law, they then went back and began to press these suits. So talk about justice denied.
Yeah.
You know, it took almost an entire century. But the interesting thing right now is the legal momentum has been on the side of the tribes, which has given the tribes a really big stake in this and has forced other constituent groups to work with the tribes. Now, as you'll see in the case, I think the tribes have actually been relatively generous. They are interested in getting along with their neighbors, right? And there's been a really ugly history of racism against the tribes in this area anyway. But and these disputes have fanned some of that anti-tribe sentiment. Because a lot of the farming communities, not just the farmers, but the local people, see the tribes as benefiting from federal largesse of not being productive as a society, you know. There's oftentimes cultural misunderstandings about tribalism. Nonetheless, the tribes have gained some good legal standing in this. Yeah, Rebecca?
I'm wondering, in the defeat of the Modoc tribe, how many people were killed?
There were 100, I think about a third of the tribe died. It was a pretty small tribe at that point. They had already been killed. The biggest problem with these tribes was smallpox. I mean, these tribes were decimated before settlers even really got there by smallpox. But the remaining tribes then had these tribal conflicts. A lot of the tribe died between going from Northern California to Chicago to Oklahoma. It was a land crossing. So it was a very small remnant of the tribe. It's still very small today, but they've started to rebound in numbers in the hundreds.
Are any of the tribe members participating in the farming at all?
Some are. There are. That was the whole effort of the Termination Act in the 1950s, was to terminate their tribal ties and assimilate them in the economy. Some did become farmers in that area, so some do have a vested interest in farming as well. Okay, so here's what I'd like you to do. We've got about 45 minutes left, and people need to leave early, I certainly understand, but I want to take the next 10 minutes or so to actually begin to flesh out the positions of these different farmers. And I have 6 different constituents who show up, some named, some unnamed, in the group there. Kevin Andrews represents an environmental group called Wild Oregon Now, and their basic position is that the farming economy is unsustainable. We need to reduce farming, at least get it off the wildlife refuges. Charlotte Burke is a representative of the Pacific Salmon Fishermen, where they're arguing we need to get more water in Hammond River to let the fisheries rebound. Stan Marshall is a Tule Lake, two Tule Lake farmers in this case. Stan Marshall is a Tule Lake farmer, goes back several generations, who thinks we should have this legislation. The farmer is going to have to compromise, and is working in favor of compromise. Jim Stevens is his neighbor, also a farmer. They've grown up together. He is opposing the legislation. He thinks this is an example of federal overreach and it's a conspiracy against the farmers, part of the kind of rural cleansing vision. Frank Chiliquin is a member of the Klamath Tribes who supports the treaty. The Klamath Tribes voted about 560 to 440 in favor of the treaty, but it was a close decision on that. So the Klamath Tribes have been in favor of the new legislation, but the Hoopa Valley Tribe has opposed it, along with the Yurok and a couple other ones. So Rebecca Genshaw represents that there. So I'm going to just, let me just do this. We'll have all those crazy people up in the balcony. If you would be the environmentalist with Wild Oregon Now, your position is represented on page 148, 152 to 153 there. We'll have the folks in the back over there, Monica and Ron, folks in there. If you would be Charlotte Burke, the Pacific Salmon folks there. Have the people up in front over here. If you'd be Stan Marshall, Tule Lake farmer there. And then I'd like to have the people right in this area here. If you'd be the other farmer, Jim Stevens, talk to each other about this here. The folks kind of clustered under the pole there. If you'd be Frank Chiliquin and the kind of tribes. And then the folks up here, if you would be Rebecca Genshaw, representing the Hoopa Valley tribes. I want you just to take about 10 minutes, talk to each other with the other folks there, try to understand that position that your person has there. And then we're going to open up a public forum and just I'll open up the microphone for representatives and constituents to come forward and give your testimony on that. For folks, and call me over here if you're confused about your position, what you need to do on that. All right, I'd like to call this public hearing to order. Again, I thank you so much for your setting aside your evening to come and talk about this important issue. My name is Dan Snyder. I'm an administrative assistant in Senator Dianne Feinstein's office. And as you know, Senator Feinstein has been listening to many different people on this issue, and we're trying to craft a compromise to do that, and that's why I have called this public meeting to get input about whether or not we should move forward on the proposed legislation. This congressional act we're talking about has an unwieldy acronym, but it's the Klamath Basin Water Recovery and Economic Restoration Act 2014. It's been co-sponsored by both of your California senators and also Senator Merkley and Senator Wyden in Oregon. And this is a result of 45 different stakeholders coming together to compromise on this issue. As you know, there are kind of three main things that the act will try to do. One is to restore and sustain natural fish production, provide for full participation in ocean and river harvest opportunities of fish species throughout the Klamath Basin. Second is establish reliable water and power supplies to sustain agricultural uses, community and the national wildlife refuges, and third, to contribute to the public welfare, sustainability of all the Klamath Basin communities. Well, we can only do this, however, if there's some compromise among all stakeholders, everybody giving something for the common good. So what I'd like to do now is to open the floor up to anybody who would like to give your own perspective or viewpoint on this so we can hear from all different constituencies. If you would come forward to the stand here and speak into the microphone, we will have a chance to hear from each other. Anybody willing to get us started off? And when you come forward, please identify yourself by name.
Well, I am Stan Marshall. I own a farm in that valley, and I have been there with my family for four generations now. And at the beginning, our times were very bountiful and fruitful. We had all the water we wanted. But our family understands after four generations that times are changing and that we can't have all the water we want. We know that the Endangered Species Act is here to stay. We know that the Indians have their rights. We know that there's other issues out there just than ours. And so I'm just here to say today that farmers like me and my family are willing to change. We're willing to adopt other farming methods, learning how to use less water, less irrigation. We know that our way of life is going to change, but I'm here to say I don't want our way of life to disappear. So for that reason, I'm very much in favor, my family is very much in favor of this compromise, because without compromise, there's just not going to be any winners in this situation.
Thank you, Stan. I mean, the Marshall family's been very proactive, and we appreciate your leadership on the issue. Anyone else? And please state your name for the record for the court.
I am Stan's neighbor.
What? Did I get it right? I'm Stan's neighbor, right?
Yes.
Thank you.
Jim, Stephens, I have to see my name. I've got a lapse in it. He's a good friend, a good neighbor, but we don't see eye to eye on this before. My family has been here since 1890, and they've been farming this ground. Has anybody ever had a baking potato from the Klamath Falls? It's the finest stuff in the world. It's you know, you can't replace it. And the thing that's going on here is like, did you forget that we have a neighbor, Charlie Half Moon, and he's an Indian, and he's on our side on this thing. They had a choice back then whether they could farm or doing the traditional ways. And so now, those days are past, and it's not ever going to be the same. Now, I'm willing to possibly concede a little bit. Maybe they could take a small chunk of my land and maybe put a pond on there or something like that. But I don't want to give up my living. And it's been my living. It was given to me. It was my family's living. And it's important that we keep on this tradition. Also, the one thing I'm really tired of, I was raised out west, and Washington, D.C. doesn't know anything about us. They really don't. They never have. It's always been that feeling. We're independent people out here. We need to take care of ourselves. I think they've been interfering in this, and they really want to just push us out in favor of environmentalists and the tribe and the salmon. We're part of this too, and they're really ignoring us.
Thanks very much, Mr. Stevens. Speaking of salmon.
Thank you. My name is Charlotte Burke. And I represent the salmon fishery because we all live downstream. If you remember back to 2001, we appreciate our friends upstream, the farmers, but they went through a really hard time when our environment went through a hard time. When there was a massive drought and their farms were threatened on account of that. Now, just a year later, after that bucket brigade, you all remember, there was a tremendous die-off of salmon because the farmers were allowed to have access to that still limited resource. Well, as a result of that, there were almost 4,000 jobs lost and $75 million in economic benefits that would have accrued to the salmon fishermen that didn't. Now, this is an economic impact that far exceeds what the impact on the farming community. And we really need to fold in those kinds of impacts and effects into the present legislation to accommodate for that. And one of the things that seems to be a reasonable compromise is the recent effort to remove the dams, the non-functional and out-of-date dams on the Klamath River. And we would propose this as a kind of a common sense aspect of meeting our rights while still respecting everyone else's.
Thank you very much, Charlotte. I see a representative here from Wild Oregon now.
Yes, I have two first names. It's Kevin and Andrew. Kevin Andrews. The water in the West is complicated, and dry land farming is complicated, and the idea of thinking that we can turn deserts into fertile ground, it works for a while, but we're entering a different climate regime. We have climate change that's going on. We're going to be into periods where things are much more boom-bust in terms of water, heavy droughts, maybe times when there's more water, things like that too, but it's just not sustainable to keep farming these areas in the way that they've been farmed, just because the water is not going to be reliable in the same sense that it was before. And we've seen that with the recent drought here in California over the course of 3-4 years, where 90% of the state was in extreme drought conditions. And so over the long term, it's just not sustainable to keep trying to pump water out and keep all these farms going. And we've completely ignored the concept of ecosystem services that are provided by these national wildlife refuges. There's importance to the bird population. Wetlands have important cleansing functions for the water. So if you allow more contact time in wetlands, it will create greater water quality for the salmon downstream, for example. So there's all these benefits here that we haven't really taken into consideration for these national wildlife refuges. So we're not advocating that we take all the farming out here. We're looking for a compromise. We're just, our main point here is that we want to get the farming off the national wildlife refuges. So let's do what we need to do to buy back those water rights and to take those leases, and let's get the water out of, or let's get all the agriculture out of the national wildlife refuges here. Let's put some common sense bans on pesticides and things like that to try to improve the water quality. So let's focus on getting a reduced amount of farming, allow some of the farming to continue, make more water and more clean water available for the salmon downstream so that we can kind of have a win-win situation here. We can, you know, it's just not sustainable to keep the dryland farming here, so let's reduce it to a more reasonable amount. Let's do what we can for both the farmers and for the fish, but of course there's going to be some winners and some losers, and so we'll have to figure out some ways to try to soften that landing.
Thank you very much, Mr. Andrews. I believe there are some members from the tribes here tonight as well, and I'm wondering if they would like to speak on their perspective.
Going back to the early days, our tribe has been discriminated against. We have not received the water rights that were due to us in treaties way, way back. Fortunately, we've been able to access the legal process to get some of our water rights back and hopefully our salmon back. Unfortunately, in our tribe, we have almost 50-50 split about people who support this act and disagree with it. So that makes it difficult. We even have a few that are farming. That makes it difficult. But nevertheless, the bulk of us feel that we want more water, we want more salmon, we'd like to return to a way of life that our families have enjoyed for generations. In fact, a number of us have gotten together and we formed a scholarship to send Klamath students to law school. And we hope that as time goes on, we'll be able to, through a good legal process, be able to get the rights back that we justly deserve.
Mr. Tilley, go on, you have me here for a moment. If I could just, before you go back to your seat, I have just one thing that I have learned from talking to Klamath tribes is the importance of the two suckerfish that are endangered there. Could you speak a little bit about the role that they play in the life of your community?
No. I don't know that, but I will say, however, that the Endangered Species Act is a beautiful thing, and that it really isn't so much the fish or the birds or the object of the specific object. It's the fact that if something has to be listed, it means that something is wrong, and that we have to take that into account, and we want to make sure that by restoring this one species, that the whole system can be saved.
Good job.
Thank you very much, Roger. I appreciate that. I know that the suckerfish historically was a main food source, but also a real spiritual resource in the Klamath and Klamath. And you've reestablished an annual suckerfish spiritual renewal ceremony. But for a few years, you had to actually go out of the area to find the suckerfish because it becomes so endangered. So I know it's really important for you to bring that back. Do we have anybody here from the Hoopa Valley tribe?
We're with Frank.
Few of us. Very few.
We're not few in number.
We're very few in number and not very smart anymore. But we think that the tribes in general in the U.S., in North America, have been treated badly. And We also think that this area on the board has not been, should never have been drained and turned into agricultural land. It's not meant for that. So we believe that the farmers who are there should just kind of gradually retire and leave their land, and the government should buy those farms and turn it back into the way it originally was. And that would solve a lot of the problem.
And do you have any feeling about the dams that are on the river?
Well, yes, and especially because they're not doing much anymore. They could just be taken away.
Thank you very much. And I want to really thank, this is one of the more calm, dispassionate public meetings I've ever held on this topic here. Is there anybody else in the group and meeting here that would like to give further perspective from what we've heard?
I have a question.
Yes, question. Yeah.
How many farmers would be displaced if you just bought them all out?
I think there are about 1,400 or 1,500 farm families that we're talking about. Now, we keep in mind that most of the farms are private land, but the farming that's happening on the National Wildlife Refuges is government-owned land. It's leased to the farmers. It's required to be leased to the farmers because the 1964 Kuchel Act, but that is not a present law of the federal government.
And are there families that the children don't really necessarily want to stay in the business?
Yeah, that's an interesting issue. That a lot of the people who are Sam Marshall's age and Jim Stevens' age, some of them have family members who want to continue farming. Some no longer want to do the farming there. We've seen some of those farms have been sold to the Nature Conservancy or the Land Trust in the areas, which are returned to Wild State. Others of them have been sold to other farmers. In general, the farm community is quite concerned about farmland lost to the Nature Conservancy because it's being taken out of production, and they're concerned that that would lead to a decrease in farming. But it does decrease some of the irrigation pressure on that. Yes?
To follow on the question earlier, how many farms would be affected that exist currently on leased land if that were to be withdrawn?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The total acreage of the farm is about 240,000 acres, of which I think perhaps 20 to 30% is leased land on the refuges. But I'd have to check my fingers on that. It is some of the most productive land because these are the former lake beds where the soil is so rich.
Do you have an idea of how many families would be affected by that?
I don't off the top of my head, no.
I suspect there are numerous areas in the United States which are facing this same problem. Because in Texas, we've got the Colorado River and the rice farmers. We're used to taking the water that they needed to have two crops of rice every year. And then there were species down further on the coast that did not get enough water, and they were going to disappear completely. Yeah. So we were dealing with a loss.
You're very insightful in your comments that this is if communities are not facing this already, they're going to be facing it more. In fact, and by the way, this way we can step out of character for a little bit and just talk about the issue, but in the New York Times, this morning is a very interesting article that examines nationwide where the biggest impacts of climate change are going to be. And it's predicted that the South and the Southwest and the Midwest will be the two largest areas because they're going to be faced with the most drought and the most drying out of these areas there. And then I realized that a lot of the analysis of this case is in the commentary, which you didn't have in your thing there, but in that, I quoted Mark Twain, who understood the challenges 130, 40 years ago. You may remember his little quote where he says, in the West, whiskey is for drinking, water is for fighting.
Yeah.
And already the water wars started in the late 1800s. Started a lot with hydraulic mining. A lot of the gold rush employed enormous amounts of water to blast away the soil and the alluvium in order to try to again, if the gold is there, but it hasn't finished since that time. The other challenge is we have there's a wonderful book if you're interested in knowing about how a lot of this came out called Cadillac Desert. Some of you may have read it. It's 30 or 40 years ago now, but it talks about the the whole hydraulic society got started. And the West would never be able to sustain the population levels it does without this extensive infrastructure of hydraulic dams, irrigation, water supply, and so forth. California is particularly a case in point, but certainly Eastern Washington, the dam systems in Eastern Washington have created both a lot of water available for irrigation and also the cheapest power rates in the nation with the hydroelectric dams. But it's caused the near extinction of salmon as a species, as well as several other species. So we're in this really tricky period right now where historically the West was settled under a whole set of assumptions we could put over here. But increasingly, people are moving to values that reflect more appreciation for ecological values, appreciation for other forms of life, and a recognition that the current way of life is not sustainable. And there are many people who would be somewhere in between. But part of why I think the water wars are so difficult is they really are fundamentally wars about our vision for the way life should take place and whom, with whom we live, how we share, what the future is there. So what you particularly see in this issue is people all along this spectrum here. Peter did a really nice job representing Wild Oregon Now. They are a group that originally was part of the agreements. They pulled out. They thought that the agreements gave too much concession to agriculture. And their concern is that long-term, agriculture is simply inappropriate in these really arid areas. Not only because of water loss, but especially habitat loss, the species there. And, of course, one of the things, irrigation societies over time deplete their soil. It's very difficult to maintain soil fertility without a lot of inputs up to the time there. The Hoopa Valley folks there have said, look, every time we've entered into a legal agreement that allegedly was going to protect our rights, we lose. They're very, very concerned that if they give, they have the senior water rights, if they give some concession to them, they're going to lose. Stan Marshall and Jim Stevens represent real people. Stan Marshall's a friend that Mark and I have known for many years. Jim Stevens is one of his best friends there. They're on opposite sides of this. This is an issue that's ripping apart these communities. I think that I apologize, I didn't, because I already had so much information, I didn't spend more time with the actual agreements themselves, which have probably been helpful. These two agreements in 2010, they were negotiated. The Klamath Basin, the one's the watershed, or the water hydroelectric power, and the other one is the restoration there. The encouraging thing for me is that they brought together 45 different stakeholder groups. Farmers, environmentalists, tribal members, these and that. It's probably the closest thing we're ever going to see to getting some consensus there. But what's really interesting right now, the legislation is in Congress, and it's being held up. The Senate, senators in the states, from Oregon and California, are strongly supportive. The local congressional representatives from both Southern Oregon and Northern California oppose it. They're probably primarily because they're strongly supportive of the farmers, the farmer interests there. So it has to clear both the Senate and the House, and it has to be signed by the president. We don't know yet what the current administration will be, but I suspect it'll be much closer to what the Bush administration was, which was strongly supportive of the farmers. The Obama administration was very supportive of the tribal communities. It's not that they weren't supportive of the farmers, but they also had an overall more ecological perspective on water issues there. I suspect the Trump administration will move much back more towards property rights, traditional farming, than that. So this legislation may never see the light of day again. I don't know. We're too soon to know this here. Yeah?
Do you personally think it's a good law?
If I were, and this is always hazardous because I don't live in this area, my family recreates in this area, so the interesting thing for me, it'd be easy for me, from my perspective, to sort of demonize the farming community there. This is a community that probably voted 80% for Trump, very, very conservative historically, but I've also grown up with these farmers. Stan Marshall and I are roughly the same age. I've known him since I was 7. He's a really thoughtful, progressive guy. He's trying to do the right thing. I've known Jim Stevens, not nearly as well, but I've known him since that time as well. We don't see eye to eye on almost anything politically, but he's a really good person. And so for me, having knowing the people in there, I've also known several members of the Native American groups. I don't know any people in the Pacific Salmon Fishermen. I don't live in that area. My sister Martha lives in that area. No, these are all really good people who care deeply about the space, trying to do the right thing. I don't think farming is a viable, indefinite area there, just ecologically. It doesn't mean that no farming can continue, but it's going to have to change its processes there. Stan Marshall has been a real leader in this and trying to find innovative ways to do this, to reduce water use. He has a third of his farm in organic farming now. He does a significant part of his farm in what's called the Walking Wetlands group, where this is from the land that he leases from the National Wildlife Refuge. Every 3 to 4 years, they leave it fallow for a year and let the water of the natural wetlands do. They're very good at letting the birds feed on the crops and everything. So there are lots of really progressive kind of things that can meet people partway in between these things here. My concern is long-term trends with climate change and our issues there. I just think it's going to be very difficult to maintain a water-based agricultural system. You know, it's going to be increasingly arid there. And population is going to continue to increase, continue to have endangered species problems. So my hope is that I still believe there's a role for agriculture there, but I think we're going to have to find ways to phase out at least the most water intensive. This is not to point fingers at people, but there's a lot of alfalfa being grown there. Anybody know about what alfalfa takes to grow?
Alfalfa is what my father has planted to create wetlands.
That's really interesting. Where is this? Where is
Iowa.
This? In Iowa.
Yeah.
And it may make sense in Iowa because it's a lot of rainfall.
The problem in Iowa is drainage.
It's drainage, right. But alfalfa is very water intensive.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of water. Alfalfa is not something we consume directly. Mm-hmm. It's raised to feed cattle. Alfalfa is really popular right now in this area because there's such a good price for it. You know why? It's being bought by Japan and China. That is, majority of the alfalfa being raised there is not being consumed locally. It's being set for export. In a market economy, that makes total sense. It's lucrative. It's supporting these farm families really well. But essentially what we're doing is we're mining our water in these already arid areas there and shipping it overseas to other markets there. And so in an economic sense, it makes sense. One of the problems there, the water tables in this area in the last 15 years have dropped 30 to 40 feet. Right? It was really interesting. One of the things the state agencies did in 2001, when the federal agencies turned the water off, the state agencies went up there and drilled these deep wells to buy water for the farmers, which made sense in a lot of term. They drilled a bunch of wells in California. The water supply in Malin, which is 4 miles north of the Oregon Oregon, dried up that summer. They had no water in the municipal water supply. So this is why it is so challenging, because you try to address one issue of it and it raises 3 or 4 other issues elsewhere. So I think it's going to take a comprehensive approach. I do think that the legislation being proposed here is the best compromise that I know of currently. But in some ways, it'll just buy us time. These are really difficult long-term issues. Any other comment here?
I was going to say, it ought to be. It's only pure economic things in Texas, because it's that hydraulic fracturing. We have no business using water for that in Texas.
It's very water intensive.
And very. And yet the oil and gas economy is what Texas runs on, basically. And so it's really...
We see the same issue in North Dakota, in the Bakken fields there. A lot of water issues there. People are really concerned about the aquifers. One of the reasons why the pipelines were held up, ironically, in Nebraska, which is not a hotbed of radical political economic, but people are really concerned about the aquifer there. And if once you contaminate aquifers, that's forever. You know, that's essentially, so it's a really challenging thing. So we're at 12:30, I want to end for today. I thought what I would end, this guy ended with a quote about hope, there's the bell. And I thought, give me 1 minute. This is 4 principles for thinking about the bioregional approach. I think these are really interesting. How to frame the issues here. folks who have studied this a lot suggest the following. One, we must start first by articulating a vision of what a sustainable landscape would look like in this area. It needs to reject two extremes. You can't neither the idea of pristine nature. We're not going to empty this whole area out of farmers and everybody else. This is a working landscape. But it can't also be based on the 19th century irrigation society vision. We know that doesn't work. Second, the vision must be based on the region's carrying capacity. So it's going to have to balance biodiversity conservation and human use, recognizing the Klamath as both a unique and valuable ecosystem, but it's a working landscape. Third, the vision must be science-based while recognizing the need for sound judgment of the scientific data. There are a lot of times debates about how we interpret the science, but the science is the best thing we have for long-term stuff. And then fourth, the process should begin in the Klamath watershed, should be locally based and informed, but including both upper and lower basin stakeholders, so the tribes and the salmon fishermen. But it also has to be integrated with the region, state, and federal agencies. So kind of nested things about that. And I think if we follow these four principles, it forms a promising way to start thinking about how to resolve the issue. But I want you to invite you, because I know this week has been challenging and all the issues we presented, is to feel discouraged. I'm actually quite encouraged about things here. So it's cliche-ish, but I want to end by saying the whole prayer together, because it is going to take courage to address these issues here. So let's just say this together. O God,
you have called your servants to vengeance, which we cannot see the end. By paths of the end to God, through perils unknown. Give us faith to rob with good courage, not knowing where to go, but only that your hand is leading us, and your love is supporting us, through Jesus Christ our Lord.
Amen. So I want to say thank you very much for being with me this whole week here. One of the really wonderful things about teaching at Holden, I love where I teach. I can never end a class with the Holden prayer.